We started last week looking at this diagram right here, if I have it right, right here, with him coming into, on Sunday, Jesus coming from Bethany up through Bethphage where they got the donkey and rode in on Palm Sunday, and the crowds welcomed him. I do want to have us look, just to kind of set the mood, go to Mark chapter 10. And remember, if you remember last week, Mark 10 verse 35, before they got to, he'd gone away, he'd gone across the Jordan over to Perea, and he'd spent several weeks there. He'd come back and healed Lazarus, and then he returned. And then he, on his way, he passed through Jericho because he's coming here to Bethany for this Passover. Now, Jesus has said several times, the end is near. What's wrong, dear?
I was just making sure.
Oh, okay. That he was going to be crucified and he was, you know, going to be killed. And the disciples had no idea of understanding what he was saying, but he knows he's going to his last Passover. He knows he's going to his death. But I want you to notice Mark chapter 10, verse 35, what takes place in Jericho. Now, they come into Jericho, and he heals a blind man. He meets Zacchaeus. He heals a blind man or a couple of them on the way out of town. But while he's there, look in verse 35. Mark 10, verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, now this is what they anticipate that he's going to Jerusalem for. Let one of us sit on your right and the other on your left in your glory. Now, that sounds like, you know, maybe when we talk about the glory, we're talking about some distant future, the, you know, by and by we live our lives, we die, and someday we'll be in glory. Jesus is going to Jerusalem for his crucifixion. The disciples think he's going to take the kingdom. And they ask if they can sit on his right and on his left. He says, you don't know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and gives them a talk about, you know that those who regard as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So that kind of sets the stage of even his disciples are going a completely different direction. We're going to see Judas, as we go through this week, he's going to end up betraying Jesus, and he's going to end up killing himself because things did not work out like they thought. They had, just like we have plans, and God has plans, and sometimes they're not going the same way. And so they're coming into this right here on this Palm Sunday, just like James and John anticipated. They're waving their branches. They're celebrating because here comes the king. Finally, Jesus is going to make his move. However it's going to be, they anticipate he's going to be like one of the Hasmoneans. He's going to become a king. He's going to set up the kingdom. They're going to drive out Rome. And that's why the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the priests, the scribes are terrified of what Jesus potentially could do because the crowd wants a revolt. They want a revolt. And there are zealots or domestic terrorists running around. Even one of his disciples is a zealot. But now in Mark chapter 11, we read this tonight, verse 1. As they approached Jerusalem, this is Palm Sunday. Now what we're going to go through, I've got maps for you and you've got notes with you right there. We've got Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, okay, I know this is redundant, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of this week. The Bible gives us details of all these days. Sometimes it's clear, sometimes some of the Gospels skip some of them, but this is Sunday. This is going to be Palm Sunday. He's going to ride in. On Monday, he's going to go back. He's going to be going back every night to Bethany. On Monday, he's going to come in and he's going to clear the temple. and is going to make all kinds of commotion. And everybody's going to say, whoa, what's going on? He's going to go back to Bethany. He's going to come in on Tuesday, and he's going to go to the Temple Mount, and everyone, all the authorities are ready for him, and they're going to begin asking him questions. By what authority are you doing these things? And the Sadducees are going to ask him a question. The Pharisees are going to ask him. And this is all recorded on what they're challenging him. What are you doing? And then he tells them. And then he's going to spend some time doing a lot of teaching and explaining there on the Temple Mount on Tuesday. Wednesday, he's going to go to Bethany and stay home. He's staying home because this, I would guess, this is his day, not his Sabbath day of rest, but I think he's probably just taking the day off because he's going to say that Passover is 2 days away. That night, he's going to be at Simon the leper's house, and he's going to be anointed. He was already anointed earlier, remember when Martha anointed him. Now someone else is going to anoint him. Before, the first time, Judas got mad. This time it says all the disciples got mad because you wasted so much money on this perfume at Simon the leper's house. Then on Thursday, he's going to go into the town, and that's, he tells his disciples to get ready for the feast. And they're going to have the big meal for the celebration meal, but we know it as the Last Supper. He's going to eat there, and they're thinking, boy, tomorrow's showdown. It's going to be the big day, the big feast, and they're getting ready for it. But Jesus washes their feet and tells them several things about, you know, how he's going to be going away, and tries to explain it, and they're not ready. That night they go out, and the disciples leave the Last Supper and think they're going to go and spend the night sleeping on the Mount of Olives so they can come back in because they get done with the meal at midnight. Jesus starts to pray until about 2 o'clock in the morning. We don't have exact times. And at that time, Judas is going to lead a group out, and they're going to arrest Jesus late Thursday night, or actually, it'd probably be early Friday morning. He is arrested. And then on Friday, they're going to take one and two trials before the sun comes up. The godfather of the priesthood, who's the retired priest, the Romans removed him from being the high priest, Annas, and put his son-in-law, Caiaphas, in as the high priest. So he's going to meet with Annas. It's going to be the, you know, the who controls, like we have, you know, we think in our government we got certain leaders, but then you always know who's behind the, who's got the money, who's got, they're in the shadows. Someone will make the statement, someone will do the press interview, someone's got the official title, will make the decree, but who's the guy behind the curtain? Who's doing this? Well, Annas is the retired high priest behind the curtain who meets with Jesus. He hands him off to the functioning high priest, Caiaphas, trying to find evidence, and then they've got to wait until sun comes up, sunrise, and then they take him to the Temple Mount to meet for the third trial with the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin is the Congress. They're the jury. They're the ones that are going to vote. And they bring him in because these guys have found him guilty, but they can't do anything. They need to have an official vote. And the Sanhedrin, and Jesus is going to say, it's going to take like 4 minutes. Jesus is going to blow the case. What is your defense? Are you the Son of God? And he says, yes, I am. And it's like, well, we don't need to hear anymore. That's all the evidence. That's all. We've seen the Epstein files. And so they go, well, they're fired up. Okay, we've got all the evidence that we need. We need to kill him. But they're ruled by the Romans. They can't kill anybody. But we've got all the evidence we need. We just got to get the paperwork done and have someone sign the papers. And so they take him to Pilate for the fourth trial. Pilate's going to ask him some questions. And he says, yeah, it's as you say. He says, And someone's going to mention something about Galilee. He says, you come from Galilee? Well, Herod Antipas is in town. Remember the guy that Jesus was trying to stay away from up in Galilee? Would go to Decapolis or go up to Tyre, go up, you know, stay. He didn't want to have be threatened. Well, he's in town for the festivities. So Pilate says, well, Herod's in town. He's your governor over your area, your procon. So he sends him over to where Herod is staying, his hotel. He's actually staying at the Hasmonean, the family palace, the Hasmonean palace. And Pilate, Herod Antipas talks to him, but Jesus doesn't even talk. He talks to Annas, he talks to Caiaphas, he talks to Pilate, or the Sanhedrin, he talks to Pilate, but when it comes to Herod Antipas, he won't say, he just stands there. And so he then gets frustrated, sends him back to Pilate, who then says, I already declared him innocent. The Romans decide Jesus is innocent. The pilot just, and he said, ask the crowd, you know, can I punish someone else? Can I? He's trying to get out of it. And there's such a mob starts building, and Pilate realizes he's going to lose control of the crowd that he just hands him over. Well, he beats him, saying, there, I've punished him. I've beaten him. Is that good enough? And they go, no, crucify him. So Pilate just gives in, and Jesus goes then to his death and is crucified and is nailed on the cross. Listen, remember, 2 o'clock in the morning he was arrested. He's going to go through all these trials, starting while it's still dark. First thing in the morning, sun comes up, Sanhedrin, Pilate, Herod, Pilate, and he's on the cross by 9 o'clock in the morning. He's dead by 3 o'clock, which is a very fast death. Very fast death, quick death to die, just nailed to a board. I mean, he's hanging, but he can still breathe. That's why they come by and they break the legs of the thieves, because then they can't breathe. They suffocate because they can't lift themselves up anymore. So that's, okay, I just covered class tonight. That's where we're heading. Palm Sunday, clears the temple, shows up, is challenged, answers questions, stays home, and is anointed, comes in for the Last Supper, and then is arrested at 2 o'clock and goes through those trials. And that's as far as we're going to get tonight with Jesus being on the cross. My plan was to finish the life of Christ, well, and I am, I guess, with the crucifixion, but then get the resurrection. But we're going to have to take the resurrection and do that next week. So anyway, here's Palm Sunday, chapter on Monday, or Sunday, first thing on this map. He comes in, here's the crowd. And again, they've got the same mentality that James and John had. If we go to Matthew and you read that same account of James and John wanting to be on his right and his left, his mom, their mother comes and asks Jesus, can my sons? So traveling with the disciples is their mommies. I mean, in this case, mom, sons of Zebedee, their mother is with them. Well, she's there for the Passover. And she asks Jesus, can they sit on their right and on left? That's in Matthew. You'd read it in Matthew. Chapter 11, verse 1. Of Mark, as they approached Jerusalem and came to Bethphage, right here, at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you. Just as you enter, you will find a colt there and tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it to here. If anyone asks you, why are you doing this? Tell them the Lord needs it and we'll send it back shortly. They went and found the colt outside the street, tied it at the doorway. And as they untied it, some people standing there asked, what are you doing? Untying the colt. They answered as Jesus had told them, and the people let them go. When they brought the colt to Jesus and threw their cloaks over it, he sat on it, and many people spread their cloaks on the road, paving the road with their cloaks, while others spread branches so that he's, you know, being honored into the city. So they don't do this for everybody. They think he's coming to be king. They are totally missing all of his teaching. They've totally missed his pronouncement. Those who went ahead and those who followed shouted, Hosanna, or which means save us. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They're quoting a scripture, but they've misinterpreted, they're misapplying it. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Now, we all want to go to Jesus and say, Hosanna, save us. And blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. You're coming to save us. We're looking for salvation. We're looking for deliverance from, well, our sin nature, from death. They're looking, save us from being occupied by the Romans. Save us from being oppressed. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. David's kingdom is going to be restored. We're going to have someone like Solomon on the throne again. This is going to be great. We're going to make Israel great again. Hosanna in the highest. Even heaven's supporting this. Jesus entered Jerusalem and went to the temple. He looked around at everything, but since it was already late, so that means, notice how quickly they're going to get him on the cross by 9 o'clock, but he comes in the morning and comes in. This whole procession took so much time, it burned up most of the day of this whole activity, that by the time he got to the temple, it was already late, and went out to Bethany with the 12. If you read this in the other Gospels, and I don't have the details here, it says Jesus began to weep as he's coming into the city, because they're cheering for something that's not going to happen. They've completely misunderstood it. So on your notes there, on page 1, and these notes are online with some pictures on them. We just have the black and white maps here today in class. There you've got number one, Sunday morning, Jesus leaves Bethany. Two, the disciples go ahead to the village of Bethany or Bethphage to get the donkey. Jesus rides over the Mount of Olives into the city, crosses the Kidron. As the crowd waves palm branches and cheers, Jesus begins to weep for the city. That's in Luke 19. Jesus enters Jerusalem and goes to the temple. He looks around at everything in the temple. Jesus then returns to Bethany for the evening. And we turn the page, and now we've got Monday morning coming up right here. The very next thing, this is Monday, chapter 11, verse 12. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, so they're leaving Bethany again. I'm going to move my map ahead. They're leaving Bethany again. Jesus was hungry. It's breakfast. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to, quote, find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves because it was not the season for figs. It'd be like going out to an apple tree in the spring and looking for apples among the leaves, and it's like, well, where's the apples? Well, it's not the season. There's not the season for apples yet. It's not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard him say it. So he curses the fig tree. That's why we got a fig tree right here. And he curses it, and they go on into the city. Now, it's very interesting because normally, it's not the season. No one is expecting figs there except Jesus. And when it doesn't have, if they're not there, he curses, you'll never produce anything again. I wanted figs today. And it would seem like this is a representation. The fig tree represents Israel. It would appear, because here's what happens. I mean, of course, he didn't have breakfast, so he's going to be grumpy. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple area and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. Now, this has happened at the beginning, at his very first Passover. 3 years ago, he did this same thing. Now he's doing it a second time. Driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, because he uses that as an object lesson, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations? See, all nations are to be here, and it's a house of prayer. It's a place of communion with God, not you making money off the Gentiles. But you have made it a den of robbers. The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him. Now, they've already been doing it, but Jesus is just keeps pushing it. For they feared him. See, for they feared him, not so much that he's going to take their place or he's going to beat them up, but if the people follow him and his potential, it could be disastrous for them. And so they're going to kill Jesus to avoid the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, but by killing him, they bring about. So no one understands what's taking place. They think if we can get rid of him, we can then save our nation, save our temple, save our city. But by killing him, they actually unleash the judgment of God, and that's coming up here in these other verses. The chief priests and teachers of the law heard and began looking for a way to kill him, and they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, they went out of the city. And where did they go? They're going to go now back to Bethany. And now there's the temple courts. We talk about this. There's the temple. There's the altar of burnt offering on the outside. This is the court for the priest, this area. So the high priest could go in here. The priest could function here. The high priest go back here once a year. The priest could function in here. This would be the court for men here. This is the court for the Gentiles out here. Gentiles could come here and here. And this is probably where Jesus was turning the tables over. He wasn't up in here kicking over the altar and turning over all the incense burners and things. He was out here in the courts where they turned the courts of the Gentiles into business opportunities. The women court was here. This is Israel men, the women here. Anyway, there you can see Solomon's porch. We'll see a picture of that again later here. That's a colonnaded street going all the way around. Here's, you go down this you go into this tunnel here and come out on these steps, and we'll see a picture of that here in a moment. Here is here's the temple courts right here, where it was. The Dome of the Rock stands there. I want to point this out. This is where Jesus is going to be crucified. That's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Jesus will be crucified under this. Now, again, this was all bare. Obviously, the city wasn't there. But this was outside the city walls at that time. You can see right here on your maps where the cross is at up there, right on that top corner right up here where the cross is. That is outside right there. That's where that building's at. That's the two domes. There's the Garden of the Rock of Calvary, where the crosses were, and then there's a garden here with whom they've just done some new excavation here again, and they found that this was a garden. It had been an abandoned quarry. They just recently re-excavated these things and found it to be the case. So this was a rocky place that had the crosses on it. This was a rocky place that had tombs cut into it. And it was outside the city walls. Now, as you see right here today, there it is. That's over Calvary. That's over the quarry. And this is over where the tombs were. And there's even still graves inside. I'll show you some pictures of that inside here. But that was on the outside the city walls. So that's where Jesus came and cleared the temple. Here is Solomon's colonnade going around here. See that? These are the steps he would have walked out this door. There's a double gate there. He would have gone down these steps. I'll show you some pictures of those. There's the Mount of Olives up there again. And this is the building on that top right here where the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is there today, but it would have been up here where he possibly was looking to jump. Now this is going to be Tuesday. He's in Bethany. He's going to leave and come back up and enter the court again. And we now begin chapter 11 of Mark, verse 20. In the morning, this would be Tuesday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. In the morning, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. Peter remembered and said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered." Jesus says, "Have faith in God. I tell you the truth. If anyone says to this mountain, 'Go throw yourself into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you receive it, and it will be yours." Now, it's interesting that Jesus is standing right here on the Mount of Olives, and when the Messiah comes, he's going to return. We can find several places. He's going to return to the Mount of Olives. That's why all the graves are there. Jews believe that about their Messiah. We believe that about Jesus. He's going to land there. There's going to be an earthquake, part of the mountain moving south, part moving north. It says that in Zechariah. And then water's going to flow out of there. And this mountain will be, at that time, thrown into the sea. The sea is going to come out of this, and water's going to flow from here to the Mediterranean Sea and here into the Dead Sea down there. The Dead Sea is going to fill up with water, the prophecies in the Old Testament, and water will flow from the Dead Sea, that's the lowest place on earth, but it'll flow down a river into the Gulf of Aqaba, and this will be the seaport of the world when that takes place. I mean, if you put that together like that. Anyway, so when Jesus says, if you trust God, you can say to this mountain, be cast into the sea, and it will be so. It's like, wow, and then you think of picking the mountain up and throwing it into the ocean or something like that. It's like, no, when he returns and he lands, it's going to split apart, water's going to come out and bury the place in water. Anyway, in verse 20, chapter 11, verse 27, they arrived again in Jerusalem. Now, this is Tuesday, and he's just cleared the temple. Palm Sunday, everybody's cheering for him. Monday, he comes in, dumps all the tables over. Now he shows up, and they're going to have some questions. They've been waiting for him. They've been planning all their all the press conferences are set, and all the talk shows have got him scheduled. They're going to get him with all the questions. They arrived again in Jerusalem. Now, again, the disciples are not any support. They're still in learning mode. They think he's going to become king here real quickly. And where are you going to be? Well, I hope I'm going to be the treasurer. And Judas is probably thinking he's going to be the treasurer because he's in charge of the money bag and he's been stealing from it. And so he's trying to figure out how he's going to get it balanced back up. That may be why people say he sold Jesus for the coins, because he's not betraying Jesus. If his plan was to kill Jesus, if Judas's plan was to kill Jesus, it worked perfectly. I mean, you're free. No one's going to hold you accountable for any of the money missing. But he thought Jesus, just like James and John thought Jesus was coming into his kingdom, Judas thinks he's coming into the kingdom, and we're going to ask for the money bag, balance the account, and I'm short, you know, about 30 pieces of silver. I'll just sell him for 30 pieces of silver, balance the book, set the situation up where he's going to have to call on the host of heaven, have a revolt, and bring the kingdom in. Judas is like, yeah, this is going to, he's got this. I'm going to balance the books, set up the situation, create a chance for Jesus to confront his enemies. This is going to work out perfect. And then he sees him go to the cross. He's got the money. He didn't even want the money. What's he do with the money? He takes it back and throws it at the priest, says, I don't want this. It didn't work out at all. It's like he blew the whole thing. Judas screwed up the plan of God. He screwed up the kingdom of God, he thinks. Again, I'm not reading Judas's mind, but unless he's, you know, one time he wants to kill Jesus, now I feel sorry for Jesus, now I don't know. He was just like the disciples. Nonetheless, they come in. They arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, he goes right back to the temple courts. This is the third day in a row he's been in the temple courts. The chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders came to him. By what authority are you doing these things, they asked, and who gave you authority to do this? Jesus replied, I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I am doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from men? Tell me. They say, what authority? Who gave you the authority to come in here and start turning over tables and teaching people here in the temple like you're one of the scribes, like you're one of the priests? Who gave you the authority to do this? Well, he said, I'll answer that. But you answer my question. John, who gave him authority? John's out there in the wilderness baptizing people. And who ordained him? Who gave him the authority? Is he a Sadducee? Is he a priest? Is he a Pharisee? Who gave him authority? And so they discussed it. They can't just say, well, he did go to school here, or, you know, he was a prophet of God, or we supported him, or they couldn't. And they go, just a minute. Well, that should be your talking point. You should have that right there. Flashcard. Here's my answer for that. They discussed it among themselves. And guess who turned the talk show? He turns the talk show or the interview on them. Instead of him being on the spot, he puts them on the spot. They discuss it among themselves and says, if we say from heaven, he will ask, well, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say from men, for they feared the people, for everyone held that John was really a prophet. Well, he was just a man. Well, all the people think he's a prophet. But if we say he's a prophet, Jesus is going to say, then why did he get his head cut off? So here's our answer. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. Because if I say, well, I'm just a guy from Nazareth, well, then get out of our temple. If I say, well, God sent me, well, now you're going to kill me. He will later. Then he got right here, he's got several things here in chapter 12, the parable of the tenants. He gives them a parable of the tenants, how they was rented out and they didn't take care of it. I'd love to teach you that. The paying tax to Caesar, who do we pay? They try to trip him up. In verse 13, later they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. So now they're going to ask him, we can't kill him, but if we get him in trouble with the Romans. They came to him and says, teacher, we know you're a man of integrity. Yes, yes. And you aren't swayed by men. We know you're not fearful of men because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God. We're big fans of yours. You know, we've got the Make Israel Great hat on, just like you have right there. They says, you are not swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. So tell us. Now this is not a question. This is a trap. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? We're the people of God. And we're here on the temple. Should we be paying our tithe or our taxes to Caesar in Rome, a Gentile on the other side of the Mediterranean? What do you think of that? But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me? He asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. They brought the coin and asked him, whose portrait is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar and give to God what is God's. Meaning That's, see, you're under occupation by Rome. Then the Sadducees, verse 18. The Sadducees who say there is no resurrection. Now, see, these were Jews. The Sadducees were from the priests that are in the temple. And the Sadducees, in their Old Testament doctrine, in their Jewish thinking, the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him with a question. That's how far the Sadducees had drifted off. They'd become so secularized that there was no resurrection. It was the kingdom now or never. And when you die, you're dead. There's no afterlife in the Sadducees' thinking. Now, the Pharisees, they believed in life after death. So, did the Jews of this time believe in life after death? The Sadducees, no, they did not. So, they're going to come to Jesus, and it's like a Muslim asking a Christian a trick question, or a Christian asking a Muslim a trick question. Ha, I got you on that one. So here comes the Sadducees. They don't believe in the resurrection. Teacher, they said, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife with but no children. Now, really, this sounds like a Muslim asking me a question. I mean, this is the level of an Islamist trying to prove Christianity is stupid. This is the Sadducees proving that belief in the resurrection is really, really crazy. Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but no children, the man must marry the widow and have children for his brother. And that was the way they ran their country, so the lineage could keep going. Now, there were seven brothers. The first one married and died without leaving children, and the second one married the widow but also died not having children. It was the same with the third. Their third husband, no children. The wife's broken or something. In fact, none of the seven left any children. Last of all, the woman died too. All right, what's your question? Well, we all believe in the resurrection, right? Yeah, we all believe in the resurrection, which they don't. So at the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? She finally dies, and three guys show up at the pearly gates. Honey, you're home. Honey, you're home. Honey, who are these guys? At the resurrection, whose wife will she be, since she was married? Oh, three of them were married. Oh, since the seven were married to her. Okay, they went through seven brothers. Jesus replied, are you not in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God? You need to know the scriptures, and you need to know the power of God before you start answering Bible questions. When the dead rise, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They'll be like the angels in heaven. It does not say they will be angels. They are not part of the temporal world any longer. They're no longer in time. They're no longer, in a sense, gendered, in the sense that they're going to be producing. Now, about the dead rising. Now, he said, now about the dead rising. He said, now he's going to ask them a question. Since you don't believe in the resurrection, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the account of the bush, what God said to Moses? What did God say to Moses in the burning bush? Well, he says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jesus is going to say, right. And he was speaking in the present tense. He doesn't say, I was the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and now I'm your God. Now, about the dead, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the account of the bush, how God said to him, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are badly mistaken. So that was the Sadducees' attempt. Now, verse 29, one of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked them on what commandment, which is the most important? The most important one, answered Jesus, is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And the second is like this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And that sums it up. Well said, the teacher, said the man. You are right in saying that God is one and that there is no one of him other to love him. Then Jesus in verse 35. Now Jesus is going to ask them a question. He's setting the trap right here. This is what's happening right in front of their face. I'm in verse 35. While Jesus was teaching in the temple courts, he asked, "How is it that the teachers of the law say that Christ is the son of David? David himself, speaking by the Holy Spirit, declared, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet.'" David himself calls his son Lord. How then can he be his son? David himself calls him Lord or God. How can it be David's son? You've got an oxymoron. You've got the son of David will sit on the throne, but when that son of David is seated, David refers to him as Lord, as God himself. So what is it? Is it God on the throne, or is it a son of David? And they're like, now there's an answer. It's called Emmanuel. The seed of David, the seed of the woman, is God born in flesh, is Jesus. He is the son of David. He is God himself. It's not that hard. I'm him. I'm the answer to your question. But of course, the large crowd listened to him with delight as he taught. Jesus said, "Watch out for the bad teachers in all this." And in verse 41, Jesus sat down. Now, these are the questioning. And then in verse 41, he sits down after being challenged, sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put, and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came with two very small copper coins. And there are many of these. There are many of these widow's mites or copper coins. We know what they are. Worth only a fraction of a penny. They're just small copper coins. They're small. In my mind, you'll see here in a minute, you could probably get 4, 5, 6 of them out of a penny, maybe more. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all that she had to live on." And here, I'm going to pass them around. Here's three widow's mites. These are the coins right there. You can see they've got a star on one side and an anchor on another. Here, I'll pass it. I'll leave this sit here because it'd be awkward if you dropped it. But there's a bowl with all, those are just little small pieces of widow's mites in there. Those are just broken pieces. Here's the Temple Mount. Jesus would have walked out this door right here and down these steps as you go back to this right here. As he left the temple, would have came out, went into this underground tunnel, came out on these steps, double gate, down the steps, and went back. And this is that right here. The Crusaders built a wall up against the double gate and that was blocked shut for protection. But these are the remains of the steps right there that he would have walked down when he left the temple. There you can see the steps right here. They're still carved there. That's Mount Moriah that Abraham walked up to sacrifice Isaac. That's the bedrock. And they carved stones into the very bedrock. There's a model of it. There's the double gate. There's the stones, stone steps. That's the bedrock cut into stones. See, they put some modern stones up here to keep it walkable. But otherwise, you can still see something. That's me standing at the top of it. There's the double gate. You can only see half of the double gate. It's blocked shut. And you can go in there and still see the ceiling inside that gate. You can still see up in there. I can't go in there because you have to be Muslim. It's underneath the dome of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And there's those steps looking down to the Kidron Valley and up the Mount of Olives. Those steps. There's those widows might see the star. And then there's a star. And there's part of an anchor on the widow's mites. And here's the backside of those same widow's mites. And there's that pan with those widow's mites. And you see them right there. The stars, the anchors, these are all broken pieces. These are fragments of widow's mites. And that is not, it's like, whoo, ah, that's not unusual. I mean, they're available. This is Wednesday. And on Wednesday, you can see right here, I turn the page, Wednesday. Jesus probably spends the day in Bethany and does not go into Jerusalem. Jesus tells his disciples that the Passover is 2 days away. We're going to pick up now in Matthew 26. And we're going to find out in Matthew 26, verse 1, that the chief priests are looking for a way to kill Jesus. At the evening meal at the house of Simon the leper, back in Bethany, Jesus is anointed. And this time, all of his disciples object to the waste of the valuable oil. Judas at this time goes to the chief priest to discuss a way to betray Jesus. And that's beginning in, we're going to go to Matthew 26 and read just a little bit here. Matthew 26, verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all of these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." And if you're thinking he's going to become king, and he's going to overthrow the Romans, and no one can stop him, he can raise the dead, he can outwit them, he can outquestion, what does he mean when he says crucify? Because surely no one is going to nail him on a cross. I mean, they can't even win an argument against him. So when he says they're trying to figure out the parable. The Son of Man will be crucified. I wonder what that's going to look like. And that's why they're just so astonished when they actually see it happen. I mean, you can just imagine they're thinking he's going to be the next ruler of Israel, the next ruler of the Romans or the world, and then he's dying on a cross. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name is Caiaphas. Jesus will be there in a couple mornings. And they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him, but not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. While Jesus was in Bethany, that's all day and then into the evening, in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, probably not a leper anymore, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar. Remember, last time it was Mary. This is just an unnamed woman, and she's not in Mary and Martha and Lazarus' house. She's in Simon the leper's house. Very expensive perfume, which was poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. They used to not sit at chairs. They used to, like, lean and kind of lean at a table. It would be lower tables, possibly. When the disciples, see, that's plural. The first time in John chapter 12, it was just Judas. Now it's when the disciples saw this, because this is a different situation or different setting. They were indignant. Why this waste? And they asked, this perfume could have been sold as a high price. Who's having influence on the group? Judas is influenced. Last time it was just Judas. Now all of them, yeah, I'm going to be on Judas was being more financially responsible, concerned about the poor. We're all like Judas now. See, who's winning the crowd? Aware of this, Jesus said to them, "Why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. I tell you the truth." Now then you wonder, does she understand? Does she have an insight? I mean, she's preparing. Does she do it? Is it just a coincidence and God caused her to do it? Or is she like putting two and two together and getting four? Oh my gosh. I mean, we don't know. "When she poured the perfume on my body, she did it in to prepare me for burial. I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Now we're going to Thursday. That's Wednesday. And here is, oops, I turned my page, but that doesn't turn my screen. Okay, now he's going to come into the city. He's probably going to go down in this part of the town. We don't know where this is at. You can tell kind of as the story's going that this is kind of the rich part of the town. This is where the high priest quarter, house of Caiaphas, is right there. That's where Jesus is going to be tried. In the same area is John Mark's mother's house. This is probably the upper room. Again, I have Bible study in my house, so this is an awkward thing to say. But usually when they would have meetings, especially the early church, they would meet in a larger, wealthy person's house. And John Mark, his mother, had a large house. They had 120 people in the upper room, upstairs room, when the day of Pentecost came. Jesus has got a room set up there for him to have his disciples have a supper. John Mark is probably, if this is the right house, probably 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. He's probably young. He's going to end up traveling with Peter. He's going to be he's a scribe. He writes for Paul. He writes for Peter. He's probably the young man who came out here and watched Jesus get arrested. And then when they saw him in the bush, they tried to grab him. He dropped his robe, his bedclothes, and ran back home because Jesus will be arrested at 2:00. And all this is taking place now in an upper room in John Mark's house at the Last Supper right here. So this is where the Last Supper will take place. And what we have right here on this page 6 of the notes, the disciples asked Jesus where he wanted them to make preparations for a meal. Jesus sends Peter and John to prepare the meal. They were told to go to the city, follow a man. Point 2, Jesus eats his final meal with the disciples in a large upper room in a home in Jerusalem. It is likely this was in the home of John Mark's mother, Acts chapter 12, verse 12. That's where the church met, it says. After the meal, they leave the city about midnight, crossing the Kidron Valley to the olive grove. Called Gethsemane, which literally Gethsemane means press of oils. It's the place of pressure, referring to a place of an olive press on the Mount of Olives. Here they plan on spending the night as they had before. They plan on sleeping there. And Jesus asked them to pray with him, and they know we're here for the evening, so they just probably prayed and then said their little Lord's Prayer and fell asleep. Jesus knows his arrest is near. He does not go to sleep and spends the time praying until they arrive, and he's probably arrested about 12 o'clock. And so, chapter 26 of Matthew, beginning in verse 17, on the first day of the feast of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to make preparations to eat the Passover?" And he gives them the answer. Verse 20, when the evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12. And while they were eating, he says, "I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me." They were very sad and began to say to him one after another, "Surely not I, Lord." Jesus replied, "The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man," meaning you're all dipping your bread in the same bowl I am, "one of you is going to do it. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him." It's written in prophecy. "But woe to the man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." Then Judas, the one who would betray him, said, "Surely not I, Rabbi." Jesus answered, "Yes, it is you." While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks and broke it, and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat. This is my body." Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and offered it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood, and the covenant, the blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many. For the forgiveness of sins, I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." In other words, where I'm going to go to the cross, I'm going to die, I'm going to be resurrected, and I will not be drinking wine again until I return, meaning there's not wine in heaven. I mean, that's not a statement on morals or anything. It's a physical thing. I will not drink this again until I return and set up the kingdom. When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Now, if we go to this next page, I believe in your notes, you can just read it in your notes, and we have to turn there. If we're doing the life of Christ and we're just flying through it, there's no time for this kind of research, but here it is. This is a table, and there's bread, and there's cups of wine, whatever, and there's disciples sitting around there. Jesus is sitting somewhere. Because everyone's saying, is it I? It is assumed. This is all based on speculation. Judas is sitting in the honored place next to the host. John is sitting, of course, possibly at his right, because John says, "I was the one leaning against Jesus." They're all reclining, and John is the one reclining next to Jesus. Judas asks Jesus, "Is it I?" And Jesus says, "It is." But as we read, we just read that in Matthew. "Woe to him who betrays me. You have said so." "Is it I, Rabbi?" He said to him, "You have said so." So Jesus is close enough to Judas to say, "Yeah, it's you." But if you read in John 13, 23 through 30, John, who's sitting right here, tells you the same story. "One of the disciples whom Jesus loved was reclining at the table at Jesus' side." So where's John sitting? Right here. Now, it could be he's sitting on the left and Judas is on the right. That could be. "So Simon Peter motioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking." So John and Peter are not sitting beside each other. Possibly John and James, brothers, are sitting by each other. But Peter motions across the table, motions to him. Maybe he's over here. Hey, ask him who it is. It probably, because no one else knows. Everyone else is surprised. So Judas is not sitting here. And Judas says, hey, is it me? Jesus says, you have said so. Yes, it is. Everybody would have known. So it's got to be, is it me? You've said so. And then Peter motions to John and says, ask him. Then Simon Peter motioned to him and asked Jesus of whom he was speaking. So the disciple, leaning back against Jesus, said to him, Lord, who is it? Jesus answered, it is he whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it. So he dips it and then throws it across the table to Judas. He dips it, brother, and either hands it to him or feeds him, whatever. They're having a fellowship meal there. And so John says, who is it? Jesus, whoever I feed, they give this to. Judas? And Judas is like, he's honored. So Jesus is honoring his betrayer. And then John is able to tell Peter. That's not something you should be covering in a quick overview of the life of Christ. But nonetheless, there you have that. I thought that's interesting. Okay, Friday. Jesus goes out, and we could read through it, and I really want to, but we do got to move through this. Jesus goes out to Garden of Gethsemane. We could read many things. I've got things written down there. John, the book of John is interesting. I've got it written down here. John 18, wrong page. It's amazing. John chapter 7 last week, we're just into the final weeks of Jesus' ministry, and in John chapter 7. Now, in John 13, Jesus starts to talk about the meal that we just read part of it, and he starts praying for his disciples, and it's called the high priest's prayer for chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. It's basically red letters in the book of John of what Jesus says between having that last supper and going out to the Garden of Gethsemane and continuing to pray. And that's five chapters of all that Jesus was saying and praying during this time period. You read those chapters in light of the Last Supper on his way to the Garden of Gethsemane. We don't have time to do that. That is very interesting to see that. But then we go to Luke chapter 22. I want to do this very quickly. Luke chapter 22. And like I said, there's going to be six trials of Jesus. Luke 22. And I'm beginning the first, he's arrested. I'm beginning in Luke 22, verse 63. Luke 22, verse 63. If we go to verse 47, Luke 22, verse 47. When he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and he's at the Garden of Gethsemane now. Luke 22, verse 47. The man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. They approached Jesus. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? When Jesus' followers saw, meaning that would be a normal greeting, a kiss. Just like it would be normal for Jesus to hand someone a piece of bread after dipping it. That was like, whoa, why is Jesus giving him a piece of bread? Hey, you want one? And he gave it to him. It's like Jesus was indicating who the betrayer was with a piece of bread. Now Judas comes up and goes, Master. And just like shaking hands, giving a hug, you know, high five, whatever, and gives him a kiss on the cheek. You know, it's like, and it's just normal. He says, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? It's like, it's just a very common thing. When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, I mean, they're not there to sleep, they're there to be him be arrested. They says, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. Now, it's not mentioned who it was. This is very interesting. Matthew, Mark, and Luke will refer to this. Jesus picks the ear up and puts it back on the ear of the high priest's servant to get rid of the evidence because one of his disciples attacked an official. Jesus puts it back on, put your sword away. And no one says anything about it until John mentions it in the Gospel of John in 85 AD. And he says, Peter did it. Now, why doesn't Matthew, Mark, or Luke say it? Now, we don't know why. Maybe it wasn't important to him. But Peter was still alive. Jesus got rid of the evidence, but now you've got testimony and a written document that Peter was, and he's having enough trouble the way it is without having a testimony and written documents that he's the one that cut off the high priest's ear. But by the time John writes, all the disciples are dead except him. Peter's been dead since 62, 64 AD. The crime was not. So that's just interesting. When you talk about the dating of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they don't mention it's still alive. So meaning the Gospels were written, 200, 300 AD. Why don't you say John knew who it was? Why don't you say who it was? Well, if you're writing 300 AD, yeah, put it in there. If you're faking it, but if you're actually a real document before the death of Peter, don't put Peter's name in there. So that's just, that's not an absolute either. And one of those struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. But Jesus answered, "No more of this." And he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and the elders who had come for him, Am I leading a rebellion that you come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns. In other words, do you think I'm leading a revolt? I mean, I didn't lead a revolt in town. I'm out here on the Mount of Olives, unarmed, and you come out like I'm going to get ready to lead a revolt, meaning you've completely misjudged what my purpose is. Consider that. Then Peter disowns Jesus. John 18, verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was one who had advised the Jews that it would be a good if one man died for the people. So that's his first arrest here. They're right near, probably near where John Mark's house is. They're at the high priest of Caiaphas, but Annas, the high priest, they're in the same, general area. And they're their question. And then in verse 19, meanwhile, the high priest, and that would be Annas, questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. So now you've got the guy behind the curtain asking Jesus, this is not official. He's not even the high priest. This is the man behind, this is the guy with all the money. This is the guy that has access to the Epstein files. He asked him about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus said, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? And then he says, if I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. So that was the godfather behind the curtain. Now he sends him to Annas. Now, Peter has his second denial there. John 18:24, 18:15. And he was asking him, standing before Caiaphas, and then it says in verse 21 of chapter 18, then Annas sent him still bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And there he's standing with the high priest there. They're asking him questions. And then finally, he goes to the Sanhedrin. And now I'm going to go to Luke 22. I'm going back to Luke 22. In Luke 22:63, after Caiaphas and Annas have seen him, they've got to wait until the sun comes up. And so the Sanhedrin can't meet during darkness, during the nighttime. So the sun's got to come up. And so Jesus is just being held by the guards. They're just waiting. And so that's why verse 63, chapter 22, verse 63 of Luke, the men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, prophesy, who hit you? And they said many other insulting things to him. Okay, so that's taking place while they're waiting for the Sanhedrin to assemble back on the Temple Mount. So that's all taking place down here. And then at sunbreak, they take him up to the Temple Mount, and that's in Luke chapter 22, verse 66. There it is, at daybreak. The council of the elders, that's the Sanhedrin of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law met together, and Jesus was led before them. If you are the Christ, they said, tell us. Jesus said, now watch this. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, watch this, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. When you are finished with me, I will be seated at the right hand of God himself. They all asked, are you the Son of God? He replied, you are right in saying I am. Now he gives them credit. He says, you are right in saying I am. Now that we didn't say that. We asked you if you thought you were. You're right in saying that I am. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips. Case closed. He's guilty. We need to take him, have him executed. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment to taxes to Caesar. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. Remember when Jesus answered that question? Give to Caesar what is Caesar. Give to God what is God's. How are you going to twist that into him saying, we can't give Caesar money? And he claims to be Christ, a king. Pilate, he claims to be Christ, which you may not understand, but he thinks he's the king. So Pilate asked Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Yes, it is as you say. Once again, yes, you've said it yourself. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, I find no bias for the charge against this man. He's innocent. Now the crowd hollers. But they insisted, he stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee, and there's the way out, and has come all the way here. It started up in Herod Antipas' territory, and it's all the way down here. Herod Antipas, his territory. On hearing this, verse 6, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because of the long time he had been wanting to see him. Jesus had been avoiding Herod Antipas. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. He plied him with many questions, meaning Herod's talking to Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before that, they had been enemies. Pilate now gets him back. See, that would be, he's gone Annas, Caiaphas, before the sun came up to the Sanhedrin for a council meeting, then sent out here, down outside the city to a gate, because it's a holy day, they can't go into Gentile territory. Pilate comes to the gate, meets him, finds out he's from Galilee, sends him back up to the Hasmonean palace where Herod's staying. That's a family palace. Herod sends him back with a robe on, back to Pilate at this gate right here. Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, you brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no bias for your charges against him. I've examined him while you watched. He is innocent. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. Otherwise, he wouldn't have sent him back. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him. With one voice, they cried, away with him, release for us Barabbas. And it ends up, he goes to his crucifixion. Now, what I'm going to end up doing, because we're out of time here, is I want to show you this a little bit in detail. Right here, this is Herod Antipas's, this is Pilate's residence right here. It's Herod's palace. Herod the Great built a palace. He has three towers right here. There's a gate right here, right by these towers today, called the Joppa Gate, goes right in here. Today, the wall goes all the way up this way. This is where Jesus is going to be crucified. Pilate sends him in, or he receives him from the Sanhedrin. This, after he tries him the first time, sends him back in the city to the Hasmonean Palace. He's sent back to the Praetorium, which is this area right here, the palace, Herod's palace, where Pilate is staying. He's the governor. And that's where he's then going to condemn him to death and is going to send him to his death, to the crucifixion. And this is an abandoned quarry, and it's been turned into a garden, and there's tombs there. And that's where he's going to be crucified. This is that wall. This is the new wall. The gate would be right up here. This is where the gate where Pilate's have been coming out and sitting right here. It's on the west side of the city today. I'm looking down the wall, looking south. This is where, this would be Herod's palace right on this side of the wall. It's still there today. You can take a tour of it. This is where he would have come out. There's a gate right down here, and you can, I'll show it to you. And he would come out here and sit, and the crowd is bringing Jesus down and away right here. This is where it's at. Right there is, again, the area where the gate, this is the city gate, the remains of the city gate. This is part of where Herod or Pilate would have come out and sat on his bema seat. That's looking back. If you're standing in front of that wall, it's, if you want to know where this is at, it's this right here, just on the other side. It's over here on this side of the city. And this is looking back at Herod's palace and at the, one of the towers. This is the verse in John. It says, therefore Pilate, having heard the words of these, brought out Jesus and sat down upon bematos, the judgment seat. That's right there. At the place called the stone pavement. There's the word for stone pavement. That's the stone pavement where Jesus would have been standing. In Hebrew now, it's called Gabbatha. And those are all words referring to this place right here. This is the city gate. Remains. Those are steps coming up into the city. They would have gone in there. On this side is the Gentile palace. Pilate would have come out and sat down on his bema seat. That's where the king was sat to judge in his place. Jesus would have been brought up here on this stone pavement right here to stand in front of the bema seat. There's Tony standing in front of those steps. There's the side of one gate. There's the judgment seat where he would have the bema seat right there. That's the rebuilt western wall. Now, west wall of the city, not the western wall of the Temple Mount. There's the steps of the gates. There's the diagram. There's the steps. There's the bema seat. There's where Jesus would have stood. Then they would have gone in the city. Over here is Herod's palace. Remains of a Herodian tower there. There it is. There's a good picture of it right there. Jesus stands right here. The gate would have gone in. See, this is all rebuilt. So this is all built up. This was a road right here. The bema seat, the gates, the steps. There it is again. That's where Jesus would have stood. That's me looking around, trying to figure it out. All right. That is Herod's palace. What I'm looking at is right down here. There's three towers for Herod's palace, and there's the gate that Jesus would have walked in right here. There's a gate there too today called the Joppa Gate. It's still got a gate. That is the base of one of those towers. That's a Faziel Tower right here. That's the base of that tower. That is that tower right now. Again, it was knocked over by the Romans and then rebuilt. See, they didn't knock this part down. It was already down. It's been rebuilt. This is a road goes into the Joppa Gate. Jesus would have walked in there. So from here, those towers are right here. Jesus would have gone up here and then gone to his crucifixion. Now, this is that place of crucifixion. Right here where these tombs are, right here. Seriously, these are some of those tombs. Those are places where they set a body in, and after a year, they bring it out, collect the bones, and put it in an ossuary. They'd wrap it in spices and set there, put a stone in front of it. Those are tombs in the back of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You can see it. These pictures I took right there. Those are tombs. Those are the ossuary boxes that they put the bones in, then put them up on a shelf. There are some more tombs. See how they're cut in there? That's cut right behind where Jesus' tomb was. That's a rolling stone tomb. That's what it looks like. That's in Galilee somewhere. But when you go in here and look, that's what you see. See those little notches in there? That's where you put the body. So he used Joseph's tomb. But you see, there's a tomb. You can roll it open. But there's several places in there. And then once you take the body, it's decayed, you take it and put it in a box. Now you can have someone else lay on that platform. That's inside that rolling stone tomb. There's some more ossuary boxes. There's that tomb. There's that tomb again. This is me. Now, this is me. I've gone up some stairs, and I'm reaching in and touching. This is Calvary. Remember I told you where Calvary was? Like, there's two gray domes right here, right there. The small gray dome is covering this. And, of course, 2,000 years of church history, they've got all kinds of gaudy stuff covering it up. Think mega church, but put it more like 300, 400 AD, and then have the Crusaders come in 1000 AD with their mega churches, and then if there's anything left there, you know, we'd have, you know, Joel Osteen would have some kind of a monument there, but that you can't get in. It's all 2,000 years is already full. But I can touch it. There's a hole right there. You can reach out and touch Calvary. That's what I'm doing right there. This is the remains of Calvary. See, it's an abandoned quarry. The stone's no good. There is now a tomb just like that. Rolling stone, see that right here? This was Jesus' tomb. Constantine is going to come by and is going to cut off all this stone all the way around. So the only thing that's left is this stone, this where Jesus was buried. The Muslims are going to come by around 1000 and crush it. Constantine's going to cut all this away. You say, well, it doesn't look like that today. No, it doesn't. All this was cut away, and all that was left was just the remains of the stone right here of the original bedrock. Then the Muslims came in, one of their leaders, he came in and crushed it down to just rubble and buried it. So this looks like, that doesn't look anything like it. Right, because this used to all be rock. It was cut out by Constantine, leaving just this tomb right here, the rest, what was left. Then they crushed it to rubble. Then when the Christians took it, they removed it, and then the Crusaders built this gaudy thing over what was left of it, the burial bench that was buried. And so now if you walk, you're walking into it, and right here, there's the gaudy stuff on the outside. That's all just decorative. But right there is the burial bench. And that's not even the burial bench. That's over the burial bench. That's a piece of marble, but it's even been cut in half because otherwise they're afraid the Muslims will steal it. So they cut it in half, so it's very valuable. But they cut it in half, it's not as valuable, so they leave it there. So that burial bench was moved by National Geographic the last couple months, the last year or so. That is where Jesus was buried, not there, but down two layers. And National Geographic uncovered that. So you can pull this off and see then a more of a middle age Crusader cover, move that, and then you can see the actual stone bench in here. And there's, again, that's the covering right there. So what you have is, this is what you see, this right here, I took these pictures, you can see this, that's this part right here, then there's space, then there's a 300s from the, like, 300s AD, a gray stone covering the actual yellow. This is the actual stone that was left. That's where Jesus would have laid, right here on the yellow. It was then glued down to some kind of gray marble slab, was attached with the limestone, the 30 AD limestone, with some gypsum mortar sometime between 335 and 345 to cover it up. And that's got something from Constantine's day. But anyway, that was covered up. And that's what you see. This is still original, about 5 feet high. About 4 feet high is still original. That was not chiseled away by Constantine. So the best you can see is this, but if you can move this, lift this up, you can see the burial bench. And that is, now, where Constantine cut this case on the backside, this is still part of the molding that Constantine cut. It's on the backside of the tomb, right there. That's original bedrock. It's got stone right here. That's how far the Muslims knocked it down, just leaving the molding around the base of that little tomb that they cut out. That's a picture of Calvary. That's a picture of Calvary. And there's Calvary. Now, this is interesting, and I've got to quit, obviously. This is inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But what you have here is a building, that gray two domes, over what used to be the garden, which used to be a quarry. This up here is the, you can go up here, and that's where I'm touching it. You can touch the stone of Calvary. That's up here. You walk over here, and that's the tomb right here. That's how close it is. I mean, that's how Calvary and the tomb is right this close. That's how close they are. There's the outside of that church. There's some more tombs in the back. That's Tony taken there. That's over Calvary, and this is over the burial site of Christ. All right, there it is again, and Oh boy, there's Pilate's coin. There's Pilate's coin. There's some Roman nails right here from that time period. In 135 AD, you say, how do we know that's the place? In 135 AD, Hadrian came in after the Bar Kokhba revolt and built over the top of what was left of that Calvary and the burial place. He built a temple to Venus, built a big platform around it, like a retaining wall like the Temple Mounds got, and made a platform on it and put two temples on top of the burial site of Jesus in 135 AD. When Constantine becomes emperor, he comes into Jerusalem and says, okay, I'm a Christian, the whole empire's true. Where was Christ crucified? And they said, under there. So Constantine bulldozed it, took it all down, took it down to the ground, found Calvary, the stone, where the abandoned quarry, built a basilica, a big church right here. If you look out the window, you can see Calvary. And then there's a big courtyard here. And right here, he chiseled away all the stone except a little stone around where Jesus was and built a big rotunda over the top of it. And then he had church right here in Jerusalem. So in 325 up until the Muslims came, you could have church in a basilica looking over the Calvary with the tomb of Christ back here. Then the Muslims came in, tore it all down, crushed that whole thing because Constantine chiseled away all the stone and just left the tomb. And this is what you've got left today now. You've got Calvary right here, and then you've got the rotunda built over what was crushed by the Muslims, and then these are those tombs I was showing you. They're back here. And you can walk in through here all this today, go through all those places there. And there is today's Church of the Holy Sepulchre today. This is the Gray Dome. There's Calvary. This is the Big Dome. That's over where Constantine's tomb was, and now that ugly thing there that's covering it up right there. And then those tombs are, you can go back here, crawl through some place and get in the back here where they didn't chisel away. You can still see places where people's bodies were placed. And there is Constantine's Rotunda. And there is Calvary. And there is, that's how close they are when I show you that picture. And that's today's floor model. All right. Father, we thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for Jesus Christ. We thank you for the freedom we have in this country to study and know these things. I ask that we would understand them, that we'd apply them to our hearts, and we'd find ourselves encouraged by the truth, the life, and the refreshing that comes from your word. And ask that we may ourselves be sanctified and become Christ-like in our own lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.